A tosser, he said. What did he say? A load of old shite. Sam sat down on the sofa with a thud, as if someone had cut his strings. Once an undercover, always an undercover. You'd be back, now you'd had a taste of it. That kind of thing, I couldn't. It was bad enough for a few weeks, Cassie. If you went back full time, I can't handle that. I can't. I was too tired to get properly angry. Frank was bullshitting, I said. It's what he does best. He wouldn't have me on his squad even if I wanted to be there, which I don't. He just didn't want you trying to get me to come home. He figured if you thought I was where I belonged.
Sounds about right, Sam said.
Yeah. He stared down at the coffee table, rubbed dust off it with his fingertips. So you're staying in DV?
For definite.
If I've still got a job after yesterday, you mean?
Yesterday was Mackie's fault, Sam said,
and even through all the exhaustion I saw the hard flare of anger across his face.
Not yours. Every single bloody bit of this is on Mackie. IA aren't eejits. They'll see that, same as everyone else does.
It wasn't just Frank's fault, I said. I was there, Sam. I let things get out of control. I let Daniel get his hands on a gun, and then I shot him. I can't put that on Frank.
And I let him run with his lunatic bloody idea, and I have to live with that. But he's the one who was in charge. When you take that on, you have to take responsibility for whatever comes out of it. If he tries to dump this mess on you,
he won't, I said. Not his style.
Seems to me it's exactly his style, Sam said.
He shook his head, shaking off the thought of Frank.
We'll deal with that when it comes. But say you're right, and he doesn't shaft you to save his own arse. You're staying in DV.
For now, I said. Yeah. But down the line, I hadn't even known I was going to say this. It was the last thing I'd ever expected to come out of my mouth. But once I heard the words, it seemed to me that they'd been waiting for me to find them ever since that luminous afternoon with Daniel, under the ivy. I miss murder, Sam. I miss it like hell, all the time. I want to come back.
Right, Sam said.
His head went back and he took a breath.
Yeah, I thought that all right. That's the end of us, then.
You're not allowed to go out with anyone on your squad. As O'Kelly elegantly puts it, no shagging on the company copier. No, I said. Sam, no. It doesn't have to be. Even if O'Kelly's on for taking me back, there might not be an opening for years. And who knows where we'll be by then. You could be running a squad of your own. He didn't smile. If it comes down to it, we'll just stay under the radar. It happens all the time, Sam. You know it does. Barry Norton and Elaine Leahy. Norton and Leahy have been on motor vehicles for 10 years and living together for 8 of them. They pretend to carpool, and everyone, including their super, pretends not to know. Sam shook his head like a big dog waking up.
That's not what I want, he said. All the best to them and all, but I want this to be real. Maybe you'd be grand with having what they've got. I always figured that was one reason why you didn't want to tell people about it, sure. So you could maybe come back to murder, someday. But I'm not after a shag or a fling, or some half-arsed part-time thing where we have to act like we're...
He fumbled inside his coat. He was so exhausted that he was pawing at it as if he were drunk.
I've been carrying this around with me since 2 weeks after we started going out. Remember we went for that walk around Hoth Head? It was a Sunday.
I remembered a cool grey day, soft rain weightless in the air, wide smell of sea filling my chest. Sam's mouth tasted of wild salt. We walked on the edges of high cliffs all afternoon and ate fish and chips on a bench for dinner. My legs were killing me, and it was the first time after Operation Vestal that I can remember feeling like me.
The day after, Sam said. I bought this on my lunch break.
He found what he had been looking for and dropped it on the coffee table.
It was a blue velvet ring box.
Oh, Sam, I said.
Oh, Sam. I meant it, Sam said. This, you, us, I wasn't just having a laugh.
Neither was I said. That observation room, the look in his eyes, was.
Never. I got lost along the way for a while. I'm so sorry, Sam. I fucked up every way there is, and I'm so sorry.
I love you, for Christ's sake. You going off undercover like that, I nearly went mental. And I couldn't even talk to anyone about it, because no one knew. I can't.
He trailed off, rubbed his eyes with the heels of his hands. I knew there had to be some delicate way of asking this, but the edges of my vision kept warping and flicking, and I couldn't think straight. I wondered if there could have been a worse time for this conversation.
Sam, I said, I killed a person today, yesterday, whatever. I don't have any brain cells left.
You're going to have to spell it out.
Are you breaking up with me or proposing to me?
I was pretty sure which one it was. All I wanted was to get it over with, do the goodbye routine, and chug the rest of the brandy till I knocked myself out.
Sam gave the ring box a baffled look, as if he wasn't sure how it had got there.
Jesus, he said. I didn't. I had it all planned. Dinner somewhere nice, with a view like, and champagne. But I suppose, I mean now that...
He picked up the box, opened it. I couldn't catch up. The only thing that registered was that he didn't seem to be dumping me, and that the relief was purer and more painful than I could have imagined.
Sam disentangled himself from the sofa and got down on one knee, clumsily on the floor.
Right, he said, and held out the box to me. He was white and wide-eyed. He looked as stunned as I was. Will you marry me?
The only thing I wanted to do was laugh. Not at him, just at the sheer screaming pitch of crazy that day had managed to hit. I was scared that if I started, I wouldn't be able to stop.
I know, Sam said, and swallowed. I know it'd mean you couldn't come back to murder. Not without special permission and...
And neither of us is going to get any special treatment any time soon, I said.
Daniel's voice brushed along my cheek like dark feathers, like a long night wind coming down from some far mountain.
Take what you want and pay for it, says God.
Yeah, if... God, if you want to think about it.
Another swallow.
You don't need to decide right now, sure. I know tonight's not the best moment for... But maybe it needed doing, sooner or later. I need to know.
The ring was a simple one. A slim hoop with one round diamond glittering like a dewdrop. I had never in my life pictured an engagement ring on my finger. I thought of Lexi slipping hers off in a dark room, leaving it beside the bed she had shared with Chad, and I felt the difference slide into the crack between us like a narrow blade. I couldn't put this on without knowing that it would stay on for good.
I want you to be happy, Sam said.
That stunned look had faded out of his eyes. They were clear and unfaltering on mine.
Whatever that takes, there's no point if you're not going to be. If you can't be happy without coming back on the squad, then tell me.
There's so little mercy in this world. Lexi sliced straight through everyone who got between her and the door. People she had laughed with, worked with, lain down with. Daniel, who loved her like his blood, sat beside her and watched her die, sooner than allow a siege on his spellbound castle. Frank took me by the shoulders and steered me straight into something that he knew could eat me alive. Whitethorn House let me into its secret chambers and healed my wounds, and in exchange, I set my careful charges and I blew it to smithereens. Rob, my partner, my shield mate, my closest friend, ripped me out of his life and threw me away because he wanted me to sleep with him, and I did it. And when we had all finished clawing chunks off each other, Sam, who had every right to give me the finger and walk away for good, stayed because I held out my hand and asked him to. I want to go back to murder, I said. But it doesn't need to be now. It doesn't even need to be soon. Someday, sooner or later, one of us will do something brilliant, and we'll have all the brownie points in the world, and then we'll ask for special permission. And if we don't, if we never do anything brilliant, or if they say no anyway, then what? That wing brush again, along the line of my jaw, to go consenting. Then, I said, I'll survive, and you'll have to put up with me bitching about Maher for the rest of our lives. I stretched out my hand to Sam, and I saw the look that was dawning in his eyes. And as he reached over to put the ring on my finger, I realized there was no jagged black terror falling through me this time, no wild scream at the irrevocable thing inches away and rising. I wasn't frightened at all. The only thing I felt was sure. Later, when we were cocooned in the duvet and the sky outside was turning salmon-colored, Sam said, "There's one more thing I need to ask you, and I'm not sure how to do it." "Ask away," I said. "Comes with the territory." I waved my left hand at him. The ring looked good on there. It even fit. "No," Sam said. "Something serious." I figured at this point I was ready for anything. I turned over on my stomach and propped myself up so I could look at him properly. "Rob," he said. "You and Rob. I saw the way you were together, the two of ye. How close you were. I always expected. I never thought I had a look in." This one I had not been ready for. "I don't know what went wrong between ye," Sam said. "And I'm not asking. I've no right to know. Just, I've some idea what you went through, during Operation Vestal, and after. I wasn't trying to be nosy, nothing like that, but I was there." He looked up at me, steady grey eyes unblinking. There was nothing I could say. My breath was gone. It was that night with the headlights, the night I went to get Rob at the crime scene. I knew him well enough to know that otherwise he would disintegrate, just smash into a million pieces, but not well enough to guess that he would do it anyway, and that all I had done was draw the flak my way. We did something good. I thought that meant no damage could come of it. It's occurred to me since that I may be a lot dumber than I look. If I learned one thing in murder, it's that innocence isn't enough. I'm not Lexi. I'm not clockwork, especially not when I'm wrecked and stressed and wretched. By the time the terrible sinking feeling kicked in, I had moved to DV. Rob had been bounced into bureaucratic limbo somewhere, and all our bridges were burned to bitter ash. He had gone so far away I couldn't even see him on the other side. I didn't tell anyone. I got the boat to England before dawn one sleety Saturday, and was back in my dark flat that night. The plane would have been faster, but I couldn't take it. The thought of sitting still for an hour each way, squashed elbow to elbow between strangers. I walked up and down the deck of the boat instead. On the way back the sleet came down harder, soaked me to the bone. If there had been anyone else on deck, they would have thought I was crying. But I wasn't. Not even once. Sam was the only person I could stand to be around then. Everyone else was on the other side of a thick, wavy glass wall. They yammered and gestured and pulled faces, and it took all the energy I had to work out what they wanted from me and make the right noises back. Sam was the only one I could hear. He has a beautiful voice, a country voice, slow and calm, deep and rich as earth. That voice was the one thing that made it through the glass and felt real. When we met for coffee that Monday after work, he gave me a long, intent look and then said, "You look like you've the flu. It's going around. I'll bring you home, will I?" He tucked me into bed, went to the shops to buy food, came back and cooked me stew. Every night that week he made me dinner and told terrible jokes till I laughed just at the hopeful look on his face. 6 weeks later, I was the one who kissed him first. When those square gentle hands touched my skin, I could feel ripped cells healing. I never fell for Sam's big thick bogger act. I was always sure there was more. But it had never once occurred to me. I told you, I'm dumber than I look. But he had known, every step of the way. And known to leave it. "The only bit I need to know," Sam said, "is whether it's over for you, the whole thing. Whether, I can't but wonder in our whole lives what would happen if Rob got his head together and came back wanting to. I know how hard it was for you. I tried to give you space, I suppose they call it, to figure things out. But now if we're really engaged, I just need to know." The first sunlight was exploding onto his face, turning him grave and clear-eyed as some tired apostle in a window. "It's over," I said. "It really is, Sam. It's all over now." I laid a hand on his cheek. It was so bright that for a second I thought it was burning me, a pure, painless fire. "Good," he said on a sigh. And his hand came up to cup the back of my head and pull me down on his chest. "That's good." And his eyes were closing before he finished the sentence. I slept till 2 in the afternoon. Sometime in there, Sam dragged himself out of bed and kissed me goodbye and closed the door softly behind him. But nobody rang to tell me to get my arse into work. Presumably because nobody had managed to disentangle what squad I was on right then, or whether I was suspended, or whether I still had a job at all. When I finally woke up, I considered calling in sick, but I wasn't sure who to call. Frank, probably, but he was unlikely to be in a conversational mood. I decided to let someone else figure this one out. Instead, I headed up to Sandymount Village, kept my eyes off the newspaper headlines, bought food, went home and ate most of it, and then took a very long walk on the beach. It was a sunny, lazy afternoon. The promenade was full of old people wandering along with their faces turned up to the sun, couples leaning into each other, overexcited toddlers tumbling along like big sweet bumblebees. I recognized a lot of people. Sandymount's still holding on to being that kind of place, where you know faces and swap smiles, and buy homemade perfume from the neighbor's kids. It's one of the reasons I live there. But that evening it felt strange and disconcerting all the same. I felt like I had been away too long for that. Long enough that the shop fronts should all have been different, the houses painted new colors, the familiar faces grown up, grown old, gone. The tide was out. I took off my shoes, rolled up my jeans and walked out onto the sand till the water was ankle deep. One moment from the day before fell through my head over and over. Rafe's voice, soft and dangerous as snow, saying to Justin, "You bastard fuck." This is what I could have done in that last second before it all exploded. I could have said, "Justin, you stabbed me." He would have answered. It would have been there on the tape, and sooner or later Frank or Sam would have found a way to make him say it again, under caution this time. Probably I'll never know why I didn't do it. Mercy, maybe. One drop of it, too little, and too late. Or, this is the one Frank would have picked. Too much emotional involvement, even then. Whitethorn House and the five of them still dusted over me like pollen, still turning me glittering and defiant, us against the world. Or maybe, and I like to hope it was this one, because the truth is more intricate and less attainable than I used to understand. A bright, elusive place reached by twisting back roads as often as by straight avenues. and this was the closest I could come. When I got home, Frank was sitting on my front steps with one leg stretched out, teasing a next-door cat with an untied shoelace and whistling, "Leave her, Johnny, leave her," through his front teeth. He looked terrible, crumpled and bleary-eyed, and in serious need of a shave. When he saw me, he folded his leg back under him and stood up, sending the cat whisking off into the bushes.
"Detective Maddox," he said, "you didn't show for work today. Is there a problem?"
"I wasn't sure who I work for right now," I said, "if anyone. Plus, I slept it out. I'm owed a few days' holiday. I'll take one of those." Frank sighed.
"Never mind, I'll sort something out. You can count as one of mine for another day. Starting tomorrow, though, you're DV again."
He stood aside to let me open the door.
"It's been very..."
"Yeah," I said. "That it has." He followed me up the stairs into my flat and headed straight for the cooker. There was still half a pot of coffee left over from my unidentified meal earlier on.
"That's what I like to see," he said,
finding a mug on the draining board.
"A detective who's always prepared. You having some?"
"I've had loads," I said. "Go for it." I couldn't work out what he was there for. To debrief me? Kick my arse? Kiss and make up? What? I hung up my jacket and started pulling the sheets off the futon so we could both sit down without having to get too close.
"So,"
Frank said, shoving his mug into the microwave and hitting buttons.
"You hear about the house?"
"Sam told me." I felt his head turn round. I kept my back to him, hauling the futon into its sofa version. After a moment he started the microwave whirring.
"Well," he said, "easy come, easy go. It was probably insured. You talked to IA yet?"
"Oh yeah," I said. "They're thorough."
"They come down hard on you?"
I shrugged. "No more than you'd expect. How about you?"
"We've got history,"
Frank said, without elaborating. The microwave beeped. He got the sugar bowl out of its cupboard and dumped 3 spoons in his coffee. Frank doesn't take sugar. He was fighting hard to stay awake.
"The shoot will come back good. I had a listen to the tapes. 3 shots. The first 2 a fair distance from you. The computer lads will be able to work out exactly how far. And then the 3rd right by the mic. Nearly blew my eardrums. And I had a little chat with my mate in the bureau too. Once they'd finished with the scene. Apparently the trajectory of one of Daniel's bullets came up almost a perfect mirror image of yours. No question. You only fired after he had shot directly at you."
"I know," I said. I folded the sheets and threw them in the wardrobe. "I was there." He leaned back against the counter, took a mouthful of coffee and watched me.
"Don't let the IA boys rattle you."
"This was a mess, Frank," I said. "The media are going to be all over it, and the brass are going to want someone to take the fall."
"For what? The shoot was textbook." "The house is on burn. He was warned to look after it. He didn't follow through. Everything else along the way, we've got the ultimate defense. It worked. We got our man, even if we didn't get a chance to arrest him. Just as long as you don't do anything stupid, anything else stupid, we should all be able to walk away from this."
I sat down on the futon and found my smokes. I couldn't tell whether he was reassuring me or threatening me, or maybe a little of both.
"What about you?" I asked carefully. "If you've got history with IA.
Flick of an eyebrow.
"Nice to know you care. I've also got leverage, if it comes down to that."
That tape. Me disobeying a direct order, telling him I wasn't coming in. Flashed between us, solid as if he had tossed it onto the table. It wouldn't get him off the hook. You're supposed to be able to control your squad. But it would drag me in there with him, and it might muddy the waters enough to let him wriggle away. In that moment, I knew that if Frank wanted to pin this whole mess on me, blast me right out of my career, he could do it, and that he probably had every right. I saw the tiny flash of amusement in those bloodshot eyes. He knew what I was thinking. Leverage, I said.
Don't I always, said Frank, and just for a second he sounded tired and old. Listen, I a need to throw their weight around, makes them feel like they can get it up, but as of now, they're not out to get you, or your Sammy, come to that. They'll give me a fun few weeks, but we'll all be fine in the end.
The shot of anger startled me. Whether or not Frank decided to throw me to the wolves, and I knew nothing I could say would sway him one way or the other, fine was not the word I personally would have picked for anything about this situation.
Right, I said. That's good to hear.
Then why the long face, as the bartender said to the horse?
I almost threw the lighter at his head.
Jesus Christ, Frank! I killed Daniel.
I lived under his roof. I sat next to him at his table. I ate his food. I didn't say I kissed him.
And then I killed him. Every day for what should have been the rest of his life, he won't be here, and it'll be because of me. I went in there to catch a murderer. I spent years throwing my heart and soul into doing that, and now I'm...
I shut up because my voice was shaking.
You know something? Frank said, after a moment. You've got a bad habit of taking too much credit for the stuff other people do around you.
He brought his mug over to the sofa and collapsed, legs spread wide.
Daniel March was no idiot. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he deliberately forced you into a position where you had absolutely no choice except to take him down. That wasn't homicide, Cassie. It wasn't even self-defense. That right there was suicide by cop.
I know, I said. I know that.
He knew he was cornered. He had no intention of going to prison, and I don't blame him. Can you see him making friends with the boys in the cell block? So he picked his way out, and he went for it. I'll give the guy this. He had guts. I underestimated him.
Frank, I said,
have you ever killed anyone?
He reached for my smoke packet, watched the flame as he lit his cigarette one-handed.
Yesterday was a good shoot, he said, when he'd put his lighter away. It happened. It was no fun. In a few weeks it'll be over. The end.
I didn't answer. Frank blew a long trail of smoke at the ceiling.
Look, you closed the case. If you had to shoot someone along the way, it might as well have been Daniel. I never liked the little fucker.
I was in no mood to keep a lid on my temper, not with him.
Yeah, Frankie, I spotted that. Everyone within a mile of this case spotted that. And you know why you didn't like him? Because he was exactly like you.
Well, well, well,
Frank drawled. There was an amused twist to his mouth, but his eyes were ice blue and unblinking, and I couldn't tell whether he was furious or not.
And here I almost forgot you'd studied the old psychology.
The spitting image, Frank.
Bullshit. The guy was wrong, Cassie. Remember what you said in your profile. Prior criminal experience, remember that?
What, Frank? I said. I realized my feet had come out from under me and were braced hard on the floor.
What did you find on Daniel?
Frank shook his head, one small ambiguous jerk over his cigarette.
I didn't need to find anything. I know when someone smells wrong, and so do you. There's a line, Cassie. You and me, we live on one side of it. Even when we fuck up and wander over to the other side, we've got that line to keep us from getting lost. Daniel didn't have it.
He leaned over the coffee table to tap ash.
There's a line, he said. Don't ever forget there's a line.
There was a long silence. The window was starting to dim again. I wondered about Abby and Rafe and Justin, where they would spend tonight, whether John Naylor would sleep sprawled in moonlight on the ruins of Whitethorn House, the one-night king of all our wreckage. I knew what Frank would say. Not your problem. Not anymore.
What I'd love to know,
Frank said after a while, and his tone had changed,
is when Daniel made you. Because he did, you know.
Fast glint of blue as he glanced up at me.
From the way he talked, I'm pretty sure he knew you were wired, but that's not what's bothering me. We could have wired Lexi if we had her. The wire wasn't enough to tell him you were a cop. But when Daniel walked into that house yesterday, he knew for definite that you had a gun on you. and that you'd use it.
He settled into the sofa, one arm spread along the back, and drew on a smoke.
Any idea what gave you away?
I shrugged.
I'd bet on the onions. I know we figured I'd save that, but apparently Daniel played better poker than we thought.
No kidding, said Frank.
And you're sure that's all it was? He didn't have a problem with, for example, your taste in music.
He knew. He knew about the foray. There was no way he could be certain, but all his instincts were telling him something was there. I made myself meet his eyes, look puzzled and a little rueful.
Nothing springs to mind.
Curls of smoke hanging in the sunlight.
Right, Frank said at last. Well, they say the devil's in the details. There's nothing you could have done about those onions, which means there's nothing you could have done to prevent yourself getting burned, right?
Right, I said, and that at least came easy. I did everything I could, Frank. I was Lexi Madison as hard as I knew how.
And if, just say, you'd figured out a couple of days ago that Daniel had made you, is there anything you could have done that might have made this end better?
No, I said, and I knew that was true too. This day had begun years before, in Frank's office, over burnt coffee and chocolate biscuits. By the time I tucked that timeline into my uniform shirt and walked back to the bus station, this day had been ready and waiting for us all. I think this was the happiest ending we were ever going to get. He nodded.
Then you did your job. Leave it at that. You can't blame yourself for the stuff other people do.
I didn't even try to explain to him what I was seeing. The fine spreading web through which we had all tugged one another to this place. The multiple innocences that make up guilt. I thought of Daniel with that unutterable sadness like a brand on his face, telling me. Lexi had no conception of action and consequence. And I felt that slim blade slide deeper between her and me, twisting.
Which, Frank said, brings me to my reason for coming over here. I've got one more question left about this case, and I've got a funny feeling you might know the answer.
He glanced up from picking something out of his mug.
Did Daniel really stab our girl, or was he just taking the rap for some fucked up reason all his own?
Those level blue eyes across the coffee table.
You heard what I heard, I said. He's the only one who got specific. The other three never gave me a name.
Are they saying it wasn't him?
They're saying sweet fuck all. We've been going at them all today and most of last night, and we've yet to get a word out of them beyond, I want a glass of water. Justin did a fair bit of crying, and right through a chair when he found out he'd been nursing a viper in his bosom for the past month. We had to slap him in cuffs till he settled down. But that's as far as the communication goes. They're like bloody prisoners of war.
Daniel's finger pressed to his lips, his eyes moving among the others with an intensity I hadn't understood then. Even for this point beyond the farthest horizon of his own life, he had had a plan. And the other three, whether out of faith in him or out of habit, or just because they had nothing else left to hold on to, were still doing what he had told them to do.
One reason, I ask, Frank said, is because the stories don't quite match. Almost, but not quite. Daniel told you he happened to have a knife in his hand because he was washing up. But on the tape, Rafe and Justin both described Daniel using two hands in the struggle with Lexi, before she got stabbed.
Maybe they're confused, I said.
It happened fast, you know what eyewitness accounts are worth. Or maybe Daniel was minimizing, trying to claim he just happened to have the knife when actually he picked it up specifically to stab Lexi. We'll probably never know exactly what happened.
Frank drew on a cigarette, watching the tiny red glow.
As far as I can tell, he said, there's only one person who was washing up, and who wasn't doing something else with his hands between the point when the note came out and the point when Lexi got stabbed.
Daniel killed her, I said. And it didn't feel like a lie then, and it doesn't now. I'm positive, Frank. He was telling the truth. Frank watched my face for a long minute, searching. Then,
Okay, he said, on a sigh. I'll take your word for it. I'm never going to think he was the type to snap like that. No plan, no organization. But hey, maybe we had less in common than you think. My money was on someone else from the start, but if everyone wants it to be Daniel... A small backwards jerk off his head, like a shrug. There's not a lot I can do about it.
He stubbed out his smoke and stood up.
Here, he said, fishing in a jacket pocket. I figure you might as well have this.
He tossed something across the table to me. It flashed in the sunlight and I caught it, reflexively, one-handed. It was a mini cassette, the kind Undercover uses to record a mic feed.
That's you flushing your career down the jacks. I seem to have stepped on a cable while I was on the phone to you that day. Disconnected something. The official tape has about 15 minutes of nothing before I caught the problem and plugged everything back in. The techs want me drawn and quartered for abusing their beloved gadgetry, but they'll just have to get in the queue.
Not his style, I had said to Sam the night before. Not Frank's style to let me take the fall. And before that, way back at the beginning, Lexi Madison was Frank's responsibility when he made her from nothing. She stayed his responsibility when she turned up dead. It wasn't that he felt guilty about this god-awful mess. Nothing like that. Once IA got off his back, he would probably never think about it again. But some people take care of their own, no matter what that turns out to mean.
No copies, Frank said. You'll be fine.
When I said you're a lot like Daniel, I said. That wasn't an insult. I saw the flick of something complicated in his eyes as he took that in. After a long moment, he nodded.
Fair enough, he said.
Thanks, Frank, I said and closed my hand over the tape. Thank you.
Wah!
Frank said suddenly. His hand shot out across the table and grabbed my wrist.
Oh, what's this?
The ring. I'd forgotten. My head was still getting used to it. It took an effort not to giggle at the look on his face. I'd never seen Frank Mackey truly gobsmacked before. I think it suits me, I said.
You like? Is this new, or did I miss something before?
Pretty new, I said.
Yeah.
That lazy, malicious grin, tongue stretching his cheek. All of a sudden he looked wide awake and sparkling with energy, ready to roll.
Well, fuck me sideways with a broomstick, he said. I don't know which of you two just surprised me more. I've got to say, hand on heart, I take my hat off to yours, Sammy. Wish him good luck from me, will ya?
He started to laugh.
Holy mother of the divine, he said. And if this hasn't just about made my day. Cassie Maddox getting married. Sweet Jesus, wish that man luck from me.
And he ran off down the stairs, still laughing at the top of his lungs. I sat there on the futon for a long time, turning the tape in my hands and trying to remember what else was on there. What I had done that day, besides go all in and dare Frank to fire me. Hangovers, coffee, and Bloody Marys, and all of us sniping at each other. Daniel's voice saying, in Lexi's darkened bedroom, "Who are you?" "Foray." I think Frank expected me to destroy the tape, unspool it, and stick it through a home shredder. I don't have one, but I bet he does. Instead, I climbed up on the kitchen counter, got my official stuff shoebox off the cupboard, and put the tape inside, in with my passport and my birth cert, on my medical records and my visa bills. I want to listen to it. Someday. Chapter 26. A few weeks after the end of Operation Mirror, while I was still fucking about with paper and waiting for somebody somewhere to decide something, Frank phoned me.
"I've got Lexi's dad on the line," he said. "He wants to talk to you."
A click, and then nothing but the little red light on my phone blinking, for a call, waiting to be picked up. I was driving a desk in the DV squad room. It was lunchtime, a still blue sky summer day. Everyone else had headed out to lie in Stephen's Green with their sleeves rolled up and hope for some kind of tan. But I was avoiding Maher, who kept edging his chair closer to mine and asking me conspiratorially what it felt like to shoot someone. so most days I invented urgent paperwork and then took a very late lunch. It had been this simple, in the end. Half the world away, a very young cop called Ray Hawkins had gone to work one morning and forgotten his house keys. His dad had dropped them into him at the station. The father was a retired detective, and he had automatically scanned the notice board behind the desk, alerts, stolen cars, missing persons, while he handed over the keys and reminded Ray to pick up fish for dinner on the way home. And then he had said, "Hang on a sec, I've seen that girl somewhere." After that, all they had had to do was go back through years of missing person files till that face leaped out at them one last time. Her name was Grace Audrey Corrigan, and she had been 2 years younger than me. Her father was called Albert. He worked on a small cattle station called Mary Gullen, somewhere out in the huge nameless spaces of Western Australia. He hadn't seen her in 13 years. Frank had told him that I was the detective who had spent most time on the case, the one who had cracked it in the end. His accent was so blunt that it took a while for my ear to catch up. I expected a million questions, but he didn't ask me anything. Not at first. Instead, he told me things. All the things I could never have asked him for. His voice, deep, gruff-edged, a big man's voice, moved slowly with big gaps like he wasn't used to talking. But he talked for a long time. He had saved up 13 years worth of words, waiting for this day to come find him. Gracie had been a good kid, he said, when she was little. Sharp as a knife. Smart enough for college twice over, but she wasn't interested. A homebody, Albert Corrigan said. 8 years old, and explained it to him how, as soon as she was 18, she was going to marry one of the Jackaroos, so they could take over the place and look after him and her mum when they got old.
She had it all planned out, he said.
Through it all there were the leftovers of an old smile in his voice.
Told me that in a few years I should start keeping that in mind when I was hiring. Keep an eye out for someone she could marry. Said she liked tall blokes with blonde hair, and she didn't mind blokes who shattered, but she didn't like the ones who got drunk. She always did know what she wanted, Gracie.
But when she was 9, her mother had hemorrhaged, given birth to Grace's baby brother, and bled out before a doctor could get there.
Gracie was too young to hear that, he said.
I knew from the simple heavy fall of his voice that he had thought this a million times. It had worn a long groove in his mind.
I knew as soon as I told her, the look in her eyes. She was too young to hear it. It cracked her straight across. If she had been even a couple of years older, she might have been all right. But she changed after that. Nothing you could put your finger on. She was still a great kid. Still did her schoolwork and all that. Didn't talk back. Took over running the house, little slip of a thing making beef stew for dinner like she'd seen her mum do, on a stove bigger than her. But I never knew what was going on in her head again.
In the gaps the static roared in my ear, a long muted sound like a seashell. I wished I knew more about Australia. I thought of red earth and sun that hit you like a shout, twisted plants stubborn enough to pull life out of nothing, spaces that could dizzy you, swallow you whole. She had been 10 the first time she ran away. They found her inside a few hours, out of water and crying with fury by the side of the road. But she did it again the next year, and the next. She got a little farther each time. In between, she never mentioned it, gave him a blank stare when he tried to talk about it. He never knew what morning he would wake up and find her gone. He put blankets on his bed in summer and none in winter, trying to make himself sleep lightly enough to wake at the click of a door.
She got hit right when she was 16, he said, and I heard him swallow. Nicked 300 quid from under my mattress in a Land Rover from the farm. Let the air out of the tires and all the other cars to slow us down. By the time we got after her, she'd made it to town, ditched the Land Rover at the service station and got a lift from some truck he headed east. The coppers said they'd do the best, but if she didn't want to be found, it's a big country.
He'd heard nothing for 4 months, while he dreamed of her thrown away on some roadside, picked clean by dingoes under a huge red moon. Then, the day before his birthday, he'd got a card.
"Hang on,"
he said, rustling, a bump, a dog barking, somewhere far off.
"Here we go," says, "Dear Dad, happy birthday. I'm fine. I've got a job. I've got good mates. Not coming back, but I wanted to say hi. Love, Grace. P.S. Don't worry, I'm not a pro."
He laughed, that gruff little breath again.
"Isn't that something? She was right, you know. I'd been worrying about that. Pretty girl with no qualifications. But she wouldn't have bothered saying that if it wasn't true. Not Gracie."
The postmark said Sydney. He had dropped everything, driven to the nearest airfield and caught the mail plane east to put crappy photocopied flyers on lampposts. "Have you seen this girl?" Nobody had called. Next year's card had come from New Zealand.
"Dear Dad, happy birthday. Please quit looking for me. I had to move because I saw a poster of me. I am fine, so knock it off. Love, Grace. P.S. I don't actually live in Wellington. I just came here to post this, so don't bother."
He didn't have a passport, didn't even know how to set about getting one. Grace was only a few weeks off 18, and the Wellington cops pointed out reasonably enough that there wasn't much they could do if a healthy adult decided to move out of home. There had been two more cards from there. She'd got a dog and a guitar. And then, in 1996, one from San Francisco.
"So she'd made it to America in the end,"
he said.
"God only knows how she got herself over there. I guess Gracie never did let anything stand in her way."
She had liked it there. She took the tram car to work and her flatmate was a sculptor who was teaching her how to throw pottery. But the next year she was in North Carolina. No explanation. 4 cards from there, 1 from Liverpool with a picture of the Beatles on it, and 3 from Dublin. "She had your birthday marked in her date book," I said. "I know she would have sent you one this year too."
"Yeah," he said. "Probably she would."
Somewhere in the background, something, a bird, gave a loud, witless yelp. I thought of him sitting on a battered wooden veranda, thousands of miles of wild stretching all around him, with their own pure and merciless rules. There was a long silence. I realized I had slid my free hand, elegantly, into the neck of my top, to touch Sam's engagement ring. Until Operation Mirror was officially closed out, and we could tell people without giving IA a collective aneurysm, I was wearing it on a fine gold chain that used to be my mother's. It hung between my breasts, just about where the mic had been. Even on cold days it felt warmer than my skin.
"How'd she turn out?"
he asked, at last.
"What was she like?"
His voice had gone lower, rough at the edges. He needed to know. I thought about May Ruth bringing her fiancé's parents a houseplant. Lexi throwing strawberries at Daniel and giggling. Lexi shoving that cigarette case deep into the long grass. And I had absolutely no clue what the answer was. "She was still smart," I said. "She was doing a post-grad in English. She still didn't let anything get in her way. Her friends loved her. And she loved them. They were happy together." In spite of everything the 5 of them had done to one another in the end, I believed that. I still do.
"That's my girl," he said absently. "That's my girl."
He was thinking about things I had no way of knowing. After a while he took a fast breath coming out of his reverie.
"One of them killed her, though, didn't he?"
It had taken him a long time to ask. "Yes," I said. "He did. If it's any comfort, he didn't mean to do it. It wasn't planned, nothing like that. They just had an argument. He happened to have a knife in his hand because he was doing the washing up, and he lost his temper."
"She suffer?"
"No," I said. "No, Mr. Corrigan. The pathologist says all she would have felt before she lost consciousness is shortness of breath and a fast heartbeat, as if she'd been running too hard." "It was peaceful," I almost said. "But those hands..." He said nothing for so long that I wondered if the line had gone, or if he had walked away. Just put the phone down and left the room. If he was leaning on a railing somewhere, taking deep breaths of wild, cool evening air. People were starting to come back from lunch, footsteps thumping up the stairs, someone in the corridor bitching about paperwork. Maher's big belligerent laugh. Hurry, I wanted to say. We don't have much time. Finally, he sighed. One long, slow breath.
Do you know what I remember? He said. The night before she ran away, that last time. We were sitting out on the veranda after dinner. Gracie was having sips of my beer. She looked so beautiful. More like a mum than ever. Calm for once. Smiling at me. I thought it meant, well, I thought she'd settled finally. Maybe taken a fancy to one of the jackaroos. She looked like that. Like a girl does when she's in love. I thought, that's our baby, Rachel. Isn't she gorgeous? She turned out all right in the end.
It sent strange things fluttering in my head, frail as moths circling. Frank hadn't told him. Not about the undercover angle. Not about me. She did, Mr. Corrigan, I said. In her own way, she did.
Maybe, he said. Sounds like. I just wish.
Somewhere that bird screamed again, a long, desolate alarm call fading off into the distance.
What I'm saying is, I reckon you're right. That fella didn't mean to kill her. I reckon it was always going to happen one way or another. She wasn't made right for this world. She'd been running away from it since she was 9.
Maher slammed into the squad room, bellowed something at me, wafted a big piece of sticky-looking cake onto his desk, and started disemboweling it. I listened to the static echoing in my ear and thought of those herds of horses you get in the vast, wild spaces of America and Australia, the ones running free, fighting off bobcats or dingoes, and living lean on what they find, gold and tangled in the fierce sun. My friend Alan, from when I was a kid, he worked on a ranch in Wyoming one summer, on a J-1 visa. He watched guys breaking those horses. He told me that every now and then there was one that couldn't be broken, one wild to the bone. Those horses fought the bridle and the fence till they were ripped up and streaming blood, till they smashed their legs or their necks to splinters, till they died of fighting to run. Frank turned out to be right. We all came out of Operation Mirror just fine, or at least no one ended up fired or in jail, which I think probably meets Frank's standard for fine. He got docked 3 days' holiday and got a reprimand on his file, officially for letting his investigation get out of control. With a mess this size, IA needed someone's head to go on the block, and I got the feeling they were delighted to let it be Frank's. The media had a shot at whipping up some kind of frenzy about police brutality, but nobody would talk to them. The most they got was a shot of Rafe giving a photographer the finger, which showed up in a tabloid, complete with morally upright pixelation to protect the children. I did my compulsory time with the shrink, who was over the moon to see me again. I gave him a bunch of mild trauma symptoms, let them vanish miraculously over a few weeks under his expert guidance, got my clearance, and dealt with Operation Mirror my own way, in private. Once we knew where those cards had been posted, she was easy enough to track down. There's no need to bother. Anything she had done before she hit our patch and got herself killed wasn't our problem. But Frank did it anyway. He sent me over the file, stamped closed, with no note. They never found her in Sydney. The nearest they got was a surf stud who thought he had seen her selling ice cream at Manly Beach, and had a feeling her name was Hazel, but he was too unsure and too thick to count as a reliable witness. But in New Zealand she had been Naomi Ballantyne, the most efficient office receptionist on her temp agency's books, until a satisfied customer started pushing her to go full-time. In San Francisco, she was a hippie chick called Alana Goldman, who worked in a beach supply shop and spent a lot of time smoking pot around campfires. Friends' photos showed waist-length curls whipping an ocean breeze, bare feet in seashell necklaces, and brown legs in cut-off jeans. In Liverpool, she was Mags McKenzie, an aspiring hat designer who served drinks in a quirky cocktail bar all week and sold her hats from a market stall at weekends. The photo had her wearing a wide-brimmed red velvet swirl with a puff of old silk and lace over one ear and laughing. Her housemates, a bunch of high-octane late-night girls who did the same general kind of thing, fashion, backing vocals, something called urban art, said that 2 weeks before she split, she had been offered a contract to design for a trendy boutique label. They hadn't been all that worried when they woke up and found her gone. Mags would be all right, they said. She always was. The letter from Chad was paper-clipped to a blurry snapshot of the two of them in front of a lake on a shimmering hot day. She had a long plait and an oversized t-shirt and a shy smile, head ducking away from the camera. Chad was tall and tan and gangly, with a floppy gold forelock. He had his arm around her and he was looking down at her like he couldn't believe his luck. "I just wish you would have given me a chance to come with you," the letter said. "Just a chance, May. I would have gone anywhere. Whatever you wanted, I really hope you found it now. I just wish I could know what it was and why it wasn't me." I photocopied the pictures and the interviews and sent the file back to Frank with a post-it that said thank you. The next afternoon I left work early and went to see Abby. Her new address was on file. She was living in Ranelagh, Student Central, in a tattered little house with weeds in the front lawn and too many bells beside the door. I stayed out on the pavement, leaning on the railing. It was 5 o'clock. She would be coming home soon. Routine dies hard. And I wanted to let her see me from far off, be braced and ready, before she reached me. It was about half an hour before she came around the corner, wearing her long grey coat and carrying 2 supermarket bags. She was too far away for me to see her face, but I knew that brisk, neat walk by heart. I saw the second when she spotted me. The wild rock backwards, the grab as her bags almost slipped out of her hands, the long pause, after she realized. When she stood in the middle of the empty pavement, deciding whether to turn around and go somewhere else, anywhere else. The lift of her shoulders as she took a deep breath and started walking again, towards me. I remembered that first morning around the kitchen table. How I had thought that if things had been different, the two of us could have been friends. She stopped at the gate and stood still, scanning every detail of my face, deliberate and unflinching. "I should kick the living shite out of you," she said, eventually. She didn't look like she could do it. She had lost a lot of weight, and her hair was pulled up in a knot that made her face look even thinner. But it was more than that. Something had gone out of her skin, a luminosity, a resilience. For the first time, I got a flash of what she would be like as an old woman, erect and sharp-tongued and wiry, with tired eyes. "You'd have every right," I said. "What do you want?" 5 minutes, I said. "We found out some stuff about Lexi. I thought you might want to know. It might... I don't know. It might help." A lanky kid in docks and an iPod brushed past us, let himself into the house and slammed the door behind him. "Can I come in?" I asked. "Or if you'd rather I didn't, we can stay out here. Just 5 minutes." "What's your name again? They told us, but I forget." "Cassie Maddox." "Detective Cassie Maddox," Abby said. After a moment she shifted one bag up onto her wrist and found her keys. "Okay, you might as well come in. When I tell you to leave, you leave." I nodded. Her flat was one room at the back of the first floor, smaller than mine, and barer. A single bed, an armchair, a boarded up fireplace, a mini fridge, a tiny table and chair pulled up to the window. No door to a kitchen or a bathroom. Nothing on the walls, no knick-knacks on the mantelpiece. Outside it was a warm evening, but the air in the flat was cool as water. There were faint damp stains on the ceiling, but every inch of the place was scrubbed clean, and a big sash window looked out to the west, giving the room a long melancholy glow. I thought of her room in Whitethorn House, that rich, ornate nest. Abby dumped the bags on the floor, shook off her coat and hung it on the back of the door. The bags had left red grooves.